When you say model, I think you're asking about the question, do we know what to do?
And pretty much.
And I think the answer is we know a lot about what can be done, but we can't necessarily implement all the things that need to be done, because some of them are related to transportation infrastructure. They're related to the way people live and work and play. So yes, I think we know a lot about what needs to be done and the multiple different things that need to be done, but actually making it all happen isn't as simple as just telling people what to do.
Sharon Friel, listening to what Diane's saying, I would take it all this rings true in Australia as well, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yes. The idea of changing that wider food environment to help people make those dietary choices, make them the easy choices. Where I live in Australia, in Canberra, there's been some really nice work done by the government, making changes to the sorts of foods that are available in schools, the sorts of foods that are available in sports grounds, changing the way the environment is designed and the way the public transport is run, and that makes a difference. It has made a difference to the sorts of foods that children are eating at schools. It's made a difference to the sorts of transport that people are using. You know, so Canberra, we love to pride ourselves and, you know, we're physically active out there on our bicycles and walking about the place. And that doesn't just happen. It's because of the way that the built environment has been designed to enable people to do that.
There's also biology. There are more than 600 genes in the human genome that are associated in one way with human obesity. So we're not all created equal, and we can't make all of these changes and expect it will have an impact on everyone. There are different strokes for different folks, fundamentally, because our biology varies.
If you don't mind talking about your biology for a moment, because back in your past, both as a public health researcher and academic, but also as a person, you've struggled with weight.
Oh, absolutely. I've been overweight most of my life. At one point, I reached 250 pounds, or what is that? What do we calculated that in
114
kilos.
114 kilos.
114 kilos. And I actually, for many years, I just left it as is and gradually grew. And then I finally, there was a trigger that caused me to say, okay, maybe it's time to do something about this. And I gradually added different strategies to my portfolio of things that I was doing. I started to walk more, and then I got a pedometer, so that encouraged me to walk even more. Then I started working out on a treadmill and lowering the fat content of my diet. So each time I added a strategy, I'd lose a little more weight, but then you reach a plateau because it only helps so much, and then you add on a new strategy. So that was the way I went about it. Ultimately lost, I think it was 32 kilos, we said, 31, 32 kilos. That was about 10, 15 years ago, and I've put a little bit of it back on over the years.
Which is not uncommon.
It's not uncommon at all. You know, I'm 60 now, so I've kind of reached that age where this happens. And the other thing is that there's good data that shows individuals who've lost large amount of weight tend to put it back on over a period of time. And that, in part, is related to what happens when you lose a large amount of weight to your metabolic activity. So I actually know that for me to lose more weight now, I have to consume less than about 1,500 calories a day, because I've done that through counting calories over a number of years and really recognized what it takes for me to do that. That's actually very hard work. So,
yeah.
You know, if I can keep more of it from coming back on, I'll be fairly happy.
Well, I mean, in talking personally there about your journey through weight loss and a bit of gain in the intervening time, what was the initial impetus, finally, for you to start counting the calories?
It's a good question. I certainly did it for many years. I went through many cycles, like many people do, of weight loss and weight regain. But I was sitting there with my partner one day. We were watching people walk across the street, and I said the question, gee, am I as large as that person we saw walking across the street? And the answer was yes. And for whatever reason, that was the trigger that it was time to do something. So one of the challenges in this area is that the triggers are not predictable, and they aren't necessarily clear. There was a good study that was done a number of years ago that asked people who'd lost a large amount of weight or gained a large amount of weight over a period of time, what was the trigger for them? The list is the same. divorce, losing a loved one, you know, those kinds of things, they're actually the same set of triggers for weight gain and weight loss. And it goes back to what I said earlier about there being many different genes that play a role in people's behavior and in their obesity. So when we talk about those 600 genes, there are also things about, you know, your ability to push away from the table, right? It sounds kind of funny, but there's been an association, for example, between how people behave at a buffet at a particular location on the genome. So sounds kind of odd, but it's true. So our how we act is not just a product of our environment, it's also a product of our genes, and it's a very complex mix.
Do we know in Australia how much of a role health policy plays in changing people's minds about their self-image and what they do?
So it's vital. If you do want to do something about, say, changing the amount of food that you eat, we know from a policy perspective the food environment cannot be full of junk. So that's a policy issue that can say, yes, we're going to do something about taxing high sugar foods. That'll help with Diane's story of wanting to change.
But that's the theory at the moment, because in this country, we don't tax big food and food manufacturers with high sugar content.
Not yet. I would love us to do so, because there is a lot of evidence internationally that has shown. So when Mexico introduced the sugar tax...
On soft drinks, I think.
On soft drinks, yes. Yeah. And that's created a very significant change to both the sales and consumption. And if we know lowering the consumption of that sort of food has very positive consequences for obesity and diabetes. So there's evidence accumulating around the world showing that it works.
But at the same time, is there something wrong with the way our government of any persuasion in this country goes, here's our health promotion campaign, here's what we want you to do to live longer and live better. At the same time, here's our food policy where basically very many parts of our food industry are given free rein to advertise any way they see fit.
Yes, and Australia's not by any means or alone in all of this. So that idea of the coherence in that policy environment is a very, very important point. So you want, of course, food policy, planning policy, but not undermining the health policy goals. We were very successful with tobacco.
Yes. And
there is a fantastic success story for how you can regulate a harmful product.
It took 70 years, though.
It took a long time, and so therefore we can learn how to do that more quickly, leapfrogging over some of the obstacles. Certainly not to underestimate the pushback that we are getting from some parts of the food industry. The alcohol industry is another one as well. If really to be true to what they were elected to do, then government has an absolute responsibility to look out for its society. And so therefore, if somebody does want to eat healthy, somebody does want to be physically active, then help create an environment that enables people to do that.
You're listening to Life Matters. I'm Michael McKenzie, and I'm talking to Sharon Friel and Diane Feingood, two leading public health researchers and advisors, about what really makes a difference in changing our approach to food, thereby shrinking our waistlines, and creating environments where those changes are long-lasting. Diane Feingood, how do we make healthy food as exciting and as affordable as the non-healthy food that is often cheaper and more processed?
That's a tough question, and one that I'm not sure I necessarily have the answer to, because when we want to make our food systems healthier, we also want them to be affordable, and we're also wanting them to be green now so that we're not affecting the environment. And each of those is actually, and even equitable so that people have access, those are all different strategies that require different deeply held beliefs to kind of change about how we go about it. Because if you want to make a food system green, you tend to want to pass on the cost to the individual. If you want to make it affordable, that's not going to work. So I think you've asked a very challenging question, and all of the conversation we've had today really speaks to the complexity of this problem. I actually think obesity is an order of magnitude more complex than the tobacco challenge, because in tobacco, we didn't need tobacco companies, we didn't need the product, it's not something that's vital to life. So we could demonize tobacco, we can try to push it away, we didn't have to work with it, and they clearly did did things that were inappropriate and challenging. But we don't really want our food companies to go away because we need a food supply, right? So that's one of the interesting challenges, and probably a place where Sharon and I don't necessarily agree about how you approach this, because I would argue that you need to find ways to have a relationship, build a partnership, and not necessarily just with the food companies, because they're one part of it, but partnerships across the spectrum. So that's a really important strategy to addressing a complex problem like obesity. It's a slow process, it's a big problem, but I personally believe that the only way we're going to solve these kinds of problems is to build those relationships that get us all moving in, as Sharon said, a coherent direction.
We did some work up in Western Sydney looking at the relative cost of healthy eating and eating a healthy and sustainable diet. And some of the low-income households would have had to have spent about 60% of their weekly income. Now, there's not a chance that households that are already financially stressed are able to commit that amount of money. So what you get happening is usually the mother, but not always, but usually the mother lives on a tea bag, and of course trying to feed the children that are in the house. So that's a very sensible coping strategy that, you know, every parent would want to look after their child. But that's ridiculous that the amount of money coming into a household can't support, you know, eating a healthy diet as well as all of the other things that we need for a good standard of living. That's a social policy issue. That's about the level of welfare benefits. You know, so New Start, for example, in the Australian context. It's also about the level of the minimum wage or even getting a minimum wage. We know that many places are not given the minimum wage. So for the low-income households, that's a big problem.
Can I put that back at you, though, and go, even if minimum wage and social networks and support were up to scratch, where's the training in food education and nutrition to make sure they actually improve the choices they make?
So they do. So there is no evidence whatsoever to suggest that it's about the feckless poor not knowing how to eat healthy foods the world over. What we know is across all social groups that there is a very relatively low nutrition literacy. So it's not just about the poor groups by any means. So there was some really lovely work done around nutrition skills. So nutrition skills coming into schools, nutrition skills available for families, part of sort of community programmes. They're often the places that get cut, though. You know, so when there's cuts to services, they're the sorts of programmes that tend to get cut. And that's just stupid. You know, for everybody, that's really stupid.
So part of the problem is what people want, right? So food production drives food consumption, but food consumption also determines what's produced. And I often ask this question in Canada. I don't know if it happened here in Australia, but does anybody remember the McLean burger? So McDonald's 20-some-odd years ago came out with a lean hamburger, but it came and went very quickly because people didn't consume it. Maybe it was ahead of its time. Maybe if they did it at this point in time, you know, it would be different. So, you know, we always demonize big food and fast food like that, but some of the food companies are actually trying very hard to change their food portfolio in a direction that will actually give us foods that are better for you. And they're not all the same. So I don't think all big food is the same. Some are as nefarious as probably big tobacco was and still is, but others are trying. And so we as a populace also have to create the climate in which these products are profitable so that our food companies can actually deliver a food supply and it's a healthier food for us to eat.
So Diane's absolutely correct. Some parts of the food industry are trying. I do think we would be wise to note, though, that in companies like McDonald's, they got people into the outlet with the enticement of the salad, but actually surrounding the salad and all of the advertising and paraphernalia was everything else that was there.
And the high fat, high sugar, high salt.
Yes, yes. And actually the sales of the other foods continued to rise. So the salad was, I think, a very clever marketing strategy. You know, that's their business, that's what they do. But we've got to recognise it for what it is it's a marketing strategy to get people in that they may not already have had coming in through the doors of McDonald's. So that's sensible from a business perspective. But there are just some foods that are just rubbish. And why do we continue to say that that's okay? We don't need soda to survive. There's nothing nutritious about it. So I would say that is akin to the sum of the tobacco discussion, but other foods most certainly not. There is also opportunities in other policy areas so that it's not just about the demonising of the industry. So climate change policy, eating an environmentally sustainable diet, that could actually be a really innovative, progressive climate mitigation policy. Doesn't have to sit in health, it doesn't have to sit in agriculture. That could be climate change mitigation, because we know that excess consumption of highly processed foods is harmful to the environment. That to me is a no-brainer. That would be fantastic.
Diane, have you ever seen in your life as a researcher in this area that guilt works in changing people's eating behaviours?
It's a great question, and I don't know of any studies that actually support the notion that guilt is a good strategy. In fact, we stigmatize smokers, and that kind of worked in tobacco in the sense that it changed people's perceptions about what the right thing to do was. But you can't translate that to obesity, because if you stigmatize an obese person, it usually leads to the unintended consequences of depression or bad feelings and things like that. So no, I don't think guilt is a sustainable behavior change motivator. Certainly didn't work for me as an individual. And as I said earlier, it's really actually quite difficult to predict what the triggers might be that lead to sustained weight loss. We certainly know a lot about what it takes to create weight loss and also what it takes to maintain weight loss, which is actually harder to do than to create weight loss. There was a program in the U.S. called the National Weight Control Registry, I think is the right name of it. Their work shows that actually it kind of doesn't matter how you lose the weight. Multiple different strategies, whether it be Weight Watchers or some program like that, which is considered healthy, or significant fasting or whatever it is, how you lose it is less important than how you maintain it. And it takes considerable physical activity and food restriction for people who've lost a large amount of weight to maintain that weight loss.
Well, that doesn't augur very well, does it?
No, it makes it challenging, as I personally can attest to. It is very challenging. But I think we can teach people things, but if we teach kids things in the classroom about healthy eating and we don't change the other parameters around them, it really isn't going to be helpful. So that's part of the challenge here. We need to change a whole bunch of different things in a whole bunch of different domains. And again, I think building strategies around partnerships that engage a large number of organizational structures and individuals in helping us move in a coherent sort of common direction, building on the innovation that different organizational structures have, but moving it in that way, I think is really the only way we're going to get there.
It's been really great to speak to both of you on this. When it comes to global rates of obesity, as you've been saying, both of you, I think, over this time, the way to start tackling that is to make sure that people don't feel like their obesity is being tackled. That in fact it's an all of life approach that just so happens to have a byproduct that you lose weight and therefore are less susceptible to chronic disease. Can I get a quick reaction from both of you, Sharon?
Yes, I mean, I think that's a lovely way to think about it. It's not about this disease or this condition, it's creating those environments that are good for people physically, mentally.
Like bike riding to work at Canberra, because it's cheaper than going in a car.
Yes. Or having public transport that's really easily available to you, it's affordable. And then your very sensible reaction is to want to do that.
Diane?
Yeah, I totally agree. It was a great summary, I think. There is hope, and there's data to suggest that things are changing in some populations and in some environments. So absolutely there are programs that we know that work, and some of those programs are spreading around the world to help children, for example. And we also are seeing that the multiple strategies are starting to show benefit in populations and multiple cities around the world.